Shaking up the format here a little bit at the Afterbeat. I'm going to introduce the podcast and my guest first. This is Rick Fleischman, of course, and it's the Afterbeat podcast. Today, we have John DeVersa, the trumpet player and composer, big band leader, small band leader, educator out of Cal State Northridge, and generally nice guy, a guy I had not met before, the first time I'd ever spoken with him. Today, we were not friends, first guest I've ever had who's not a friend of mine or at least an acquaintance, but maybe we are now in a little way. I really enjoyed speaking with John. He's got some great ideas. He's seems like a very gentle guy. At any rate, that's it, an hour with John DeVersa on the Afterbeat podcast. You can always find the Afterbeat podcast at www.afterbeatpod.com. That's one word, afterbeatpod.com. And up there, we've got complete show notes, links to our guests, sites and recordings and goings-on, as well as pictures from the session. Today, a picture of the dog that you will hear barking a little later on, who caused me to have to do a little editing. First time I've had to edit for sound on a Afterbeat podcast. But I hope you'll enjoy the talk. You can find us, like I said, at afterbeatpod.com. Also on iTunes, please subscribe. If you subscribe, then we have a way of tracking who's listening and how many people we're reaching. I'd like someday to get this thing paying for itself, maybe get a sponsor. And you have to show sponsors that you have got an audience. So please subscribe at iTunes. It's always free at the iTunes store. Again, don't know why they call it a store if you're not paying for anything, but there it is. At the iTunes store, you can find us. Look at Afterbeat Podcast, and that's where you'll find us, along with some art. And that's it. So on with the show. It's John DeVersa on the Afterbeat Podcast. Hope you enjoy it. Like the people, like the generation before me, getting those guys in here. Mm-hmm. And because I'm Carl Saunders and guys like that. I mean, they've been there and done that and seen it and, you know.
Yeah, of course.
Wipe the floor with it and all that. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, well, let's get, I wanted to get younger people in because I wanted to talk about the future. That's another reason to have you in here. Mm. Like the future of jazz. But like I had Fukushima and Ryan McGillicuddy in here talking about the Jazz Collective and kind of what that was about. Mm-hmm. And I just want to have a variety.
Sure.
I want to have a variety of people. So the variety of person I have today is John DeVersa in here and talking to me. And we were talking a little bit off mic. You're the first person I've had on the show that I don't actually know. So it's an interesting experience. Of course, you don't know me either, so.
It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's nice to meet you, too. Hear great things about you. Congrats on the Northridge winning the, what do they actually call that competition in Monterey?
It's called the Next Generation Jazz Festival. Mm-hmm.
And tell us a little bit about what that is.
It's this wonderful festival that they have up in Monterey that's a tributary of the Monterey Jazz Festival, and it's for a competition for college students and high school students and middle school age as well to come and collaborate together and meet each other and play music for each other. It's a very open environment. One of the best festivals that is a competition that I've ever been able to be a part of.
Cool. So what do you get for winning?
Oh, the winning bands are invited to come play at the actual festival in September, the Monterey Jazz Festival.
The big festival. Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool. That's great. Is it, you know, something just occurred to me. Will you have all the same people in September that you have now in April?
We will take the same band that was the competing band last month to the festival in September. That's only fair.
Right, it seems like it, yeah.
But then, yes, there certainly are graduating seniors that won't be in school next year, but they deserve the opportunity to go up and play in the festival.
By all means. It just seemed a little awkward, like you're competing with a band in April, and then in September some of these people would be, you know, conceivably they'd be off living their lives or at least not there. Mm-hmm. So that's cool, you take the same guys.
Absolutely.
Good. The band sounded great. I mean, there's on YouTube there's some nice stuff of the winning compositions.
Thank you. I say students, I don't really think of them as students. They're young professionals, really.
Right.
They really worked hard to go deep into that music and get the most out of it. There are a lot of natural leaders in that group.
Yeah.
that really bring everybody up in terms of their passion for the music and also their ability to execute the music. So, you know, I give all the credit to those people in that band.
I happen to know they were rehearsing this morning at 8 in the morning for Reno for next week's competition.
Right. That's right. The dedication is very strong.
Yeah, yeah. So what's your story, John? where do you come from as far as music? Is it in your family? Is it something you grew up with, or what's the deal?
Yeah, my both sides of my family are pretty serious musicians on both sides.
Professionals?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your dad do?
My dad is a trumpet player.
Mm-hmm. Here in town, or is he elsewhere?
He lived in town here for a long time, and he actually played in the LA studios for a good decade. Mm-hmm. From the late 60s until the family moved to Oklahoma in 1980. Ah. And then even after that, he came back and would play, TV and film over the summers for work and then go back.
Mm-hmm.
But he, you know, and he's from LA, and he started playing when he was about 4 and a half and was one of those prodigy trumpet players.
Yeah.
And had an incredible work ethic.
Mm-hmm.
He'd get up at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock in the morning, and practice every morning as a 5-year-old kid.
Yeah, that's a great work ethic.
And his parents really gave him the opportunity to study with some great teachers, mm-hmm. and he was actually in this small Dixieland group when he was a kid, mm-hmm. called the Dixieland Small Fries, I believe.
That was here in L.A.
It was here in L.A. Wow. And they actually they put out a record on I think it was on Capitol, and they had a TV show on KTLA, a variety show for, I think, 2 seasons.
Is this the 50s or the 60s or what? Oh, okay. Yeah. The Dixieland, that's just such a great name, though, the Dixieland Small Fry. I mean, I like that. That's cool.
So, and he's still playing. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was a very passionate music maker. Influential to me when I put it together, a big band. All compositions by Dee Barton.
Oh, yeah.
Stan Kenton conducts the jazz compositions of Dee Barton.
I think at one point I had that record.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might be one of the few. I don't think it sold a whole lot of copies.
No, but I bought a certain amount of that kind of stuff when I was a kid. I was in the junior Neophonic, and I was studying Kenton. But the Neophonic had like almost nothing to do with what Kenton had been doing before that, or even after. But I became a Kenton devotee for a while. So, what about your mom? She's in the business as well. She was a player?
Absolutely. She is a classical pianist, mm-hmm. as well as when she was in high school and college, she was a operatic singer, as well as a really accomplished flute player.
Wow, so you had it from both sides.
Absolutely, yeah.
That's cool.
All those influences, you know. And my mom was great because she really loves all kinds of music. So mm-hmm. in the house, it was Aretha Franklin. It was
great.
Smokey Robinson. It was Earth, Wind, and Fire. It was Chopin. It was Beethoven. It was Willie Nelson. It was everything.
Very eclectic, yeah.
Yeah, I guess.
Was your
although dad? Although, I remember seeing a, I think it was a Grammy event on TV, mm-hmm. and Elmer Bernstein came up, and Tina Turner had just done a number, and the crowd was going wild, and he came out and said, "Well, folks, that pretty much proves it. There's only two kinds of music. there's good music, and there's bad music, and that, my friends, is good music."
Elmer or Leonard Bernstein?
Elmer.
Ah.
Yeah.
Cool.
And
a rare TV appearance by Elmer.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I thought that was right on.
Yeah, I believe so as well. So you started the trumpet because you had seen the trumpet with your dad, or is it just something that that appealed to you? When did that begin?
Well, it certainly was there, and I knew about it because mm-hmm. of the influence of my father. But if anything, I wanted to go against that.
Well, that's kind of why I asked, because a lot of people go, they pick up some other instrument other than what their parent plays.
I certainly tried.
Yeah.
You know, I started I started with piano, mm-hmm. and I sang.
Yeah.
My first real serious exposure to music was singing. You know, mm-hmm. I learned to read music singing. And then I played clarinet for like 2 weeks, and I played trombone for about 2 minutes, and there was just nothing to hold me back from that sound of the trumpet.
Yeah.
That just seemed to really, I just loved the sound of it, and it's such a love-hate relationship with that instrument. I think a lot of trumpet players might say the same thing,
because
it's just such a commitment to be able to play that, to control that instrument well.
Right.
But there's just something about the sound of that horn that feels like a voice for me.
So it's a natural, thing. There used to be, Dick Cavett when he had a talk show like years and years ago, he had a lot of musicians on, including a lot of the guys from his band. Yeah, and at the time he had Bob Brookmeyer in his band and Jim Hall and really top flight people. And he'd get these guys on as guests and he'd say, why do you play, you know, what it is you play? He had this theory that he would always talk about, that everybody is drawn to like their one true instrument, and we all have these like affairs with other instruments, but we finally are drawn to the one that we have to play, which I think is true. I think it's true, having played other instruments not as well, you know.
I think it is true.
Yeah.
I mean, if anything, I really wanted to be, I was drawn to what the saxophone does, but the sound just was not my voice.
Yeah.
I love the electric bass. I play a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
Started playing when I was in college. I played in the second jazz band, and it taught me a lot about what pocket really means.
Yeah, and you hear the band from a whole different place.
And melodically and harmonically, and of course.
Yeah.
And it really helped me compositionally. I even played cello for a little bit, but I just have to follow the sound.
Yeah.
That's the most honest place for me, is that sound of the trumpet.
So you were here at the time? You were in LA, or you had moved to Oklahoma by that time when you took up trumpet?
Trumpet? I had played a little bit, but not seriously until I moved to Oklahoma.
Uh-huh.
That's when I really, that's when I started playing in band, was, you know, reading and playing with large ensembles,
mm-hmm.
In middle school age.
So did you find a good teacher back there?
I didn't have a real private teacher until I was in college. And most people ask me if I, you know, would study with my dad, and we never did. And he knew, I think, that if we were going to work together like that, it probably would repel me like nothing else.
Yeah.
Just those family dynamics.
Yeah.
But he was so cleverly always around to ask questions, and always around to influence me in positive ways. So. He was and he wasn't, but I basically practiced on my own, but I knew what to practice,
mm-hmm.
and I was very diligent about you know, my practice routine, and I was very ambitious about what I wanted to do, especially as a middle schooler. That was a bit of an identity for me, was being in control of that instrument.
When did you begin to write?
I was always writing songs, you know. Mm-hmm. I love top 40 music, so I was always writing songs when I was younger, at that age.
What did you listen to? What were you, was the top 40 for
Richie,
you?
Richie, Michael Jackson.
Yeah.
Cyndi Lauper. I mean, across the board. Mm-hmm. Remember a Howard Jones tune I loved? And,
mm-hmm. You're a real 80s guy.
Yeah. That's
your
that era.
Right.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And then I started writing jazz stuff when I went to high school. And I wrote my first big band chart when I was in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I realized that I could use that instrument of the orchestra, of the big band, as part of my instrumental voice.
Yeah.
And I didn't even have to play.
So did you study writing, or did you just, one of those guys who just picked up a pen and wrote what you heard and hoped that the orchestration worked?
I never studied anything formally, but you're always asking questions and just absorbing the music that you're playing, and you're around musicians that are talking about music and compositional process, and so I studied in that way, I suppose, but never any one-on-one or classroom kind of study.
Mm-hmm.
Not until I went to college, and I actually studied classical composition there.
Yeah.
And that's when they were talking about all the things that I already was aware of to a certain degree, but then they started attaching names to it, like, you know, Neapolitan six,
right,
and augmented six chord, and oh, that's what that sound is, and you call it that. Okay,
right.
I know what that.
Yeah, it doesn't change what you're doing, but it makes you better able to communicate with other musicians. That's what the deal is there, I think.
It's a way of, whenever you hear that sound too, just to be able to grab it even faster for yourself.
Right, a reference. Mm-hmm. Yeah, brothers, sisters, other people in the house when you were a kid.
There are always people around, but I'm the only child.
Yeah.
But when we were in Oklahoma, my mom's family's from Oklahoma. That's why I moved there. Mm-hmm. It's a small little town in Oklahoma called Ada.
Ada. Wow.
Ada, Oklahoma, and so all my mom's sister's kid was there. All my cousins were hanging around.
That's cool.
Yeah. And people are always in and out of the house. So.
Was there a family band at any point?
No, there should have been.
Yeah.
When we moved back to L.A., actually, my dad put a band together that I played in.
Mm-hmm.
But that's about as close as we've gotten to that. I played EVI in his band, and he played trumpet, yeah.
Why did your family move back to L.A.? It's a funny thing, because there's mm-hmm. so many people came out here from mm-hmm. Oklahoma
right.
in the Dust Bowl and the Depression mm-hmm. and all that, and you don't often hear of people moving back to Oklahoma.
Right.
So then you guys came back out here just for work, or for what was the impetus? Or do you even know?
For lots of different things. I mean, our so we moved from L.A. to Oklahoma when my dad was at the height of his studio career,
yeah.
which is kind of odd,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
But he just really needed a change in his life at
right.
that moment, something slower.
Mm-hmm.
So we went there, and then we actually lived in Las Vegas for a while for mm-hmm. work, because Dad was going to work in the shows there.
Yeah.
And then for some family reasons, we went back to Oklahoma. And then we actually moved to Sacramento
mm-hmm.
For Dad's work. And he played in this music circus where they played a lot of Broadway musicals. And he had this kind of steady flow of income mm-hmm. happening with that. And one of his very good friends that he played with, Stan Kenton, with Shelley Denny, was in that
mm-hmm.
in that group. And then I believe Dad got a teaching gig at the Dick Grove School of Music.
Oh.
And that's when we moved back to L.A. And he did that for 2-3 years. I'm not sure how long.
Mm-hmm.
But the other thing that happened, too, is that I rekindled my friendship with a childhood friend, Justin Morrell.
Oh, a guitar player.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I know
and he was going to go to Hamilton Academy of Music High School
mm-hmm.
For his last couple of years of high school. So that was kind of a nice byproduct. I went to Hamilton with him
uh-huh.
in L.A. here.
Cool.
Yeah.
Hamilton's a very well-respected music academy. It's a public school, but they have their own little private
yeah.
music academy
it's
going there.
It's been
turned
amazing.
Out a lot of good people.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, a couple people in my small band, you know, went through Hamilton in another generation.
Yeah.
Zane Carney and Tommy King. And when I was there, it was amazing. Trevor Lawrence Jr. was there.
Yeah.
And Mike Elizondo. We had this incredible quartet. We call it Second Generation. And Justin Morrell.
Yeah.
On guitar,
right,
and you know, I learned so much just playing in that group. You know, we were writing for that group,
right,
and, making music at the deepest possible level as we could for that moment.
Yeah, and they give you a lot of opportunity over there too
mm-hmm,
to do
yeah.
some good stuff.
Yeah,
that's cool. So, how old are you? I'm not quite sure.
I am 39.
39. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So you're not a child, but you're not as old as me. That's for sure. That's cool. So you were at Hamilton in the in the late 80s, would it be?
Late 80s, I graduated yeah. in 91.
Mm. I'll mm-hmm. tell you a story, but I have to tell it off mic because I have a funny Hamilton story.
Okay.
But I cannot tell you on the air.
I see.
And I don't want to edit it out. So that's cool. So who did you study trumpet with when you got back to L.A., or did you?
Well, I didn't start studying trumpet until I went to UCLA after mm-hmm. high school. And one of the reasons I decided to go to UCLA, not only was it because... this may seem counterintuitive, but UCLA at that time did not have a jazz department.
No.
And so I knew I would always pursue my jazz playing and writing, but I would be forced to go into classical composition because
right.
that's what I didn't know much about, and I didn't travel in those circles. And so that's why I went to UCLA, as well as the fact that Mario Guarneri
mm-hmm.
was teaching there.
Great trumpet player and teacher. Yeah,
yeah. And of course he plays jazz as well
yeah.
as being a incredible orchestral trumpet player.
Yeah.
So I studied with him for, it was a year or two, I can't remember now, and then he moved up to the Bay Area because
mm-hmm.
He got a wonderful position up there. And Malcolm McNabb came in.
No slouch either. Yeah.
No, he's not a slouch.
No.
And so I worked with him for a couple of years after that.
So that's an interesting idea. So you did not go to Northridge or any of the places in L.A. where people go for music, for jazz music. You went to UCLA so as not to be distracted more or less by the...
Yeah, at that moment, I just felt like I was going to do the jazz thing no matter what. So this was my opportunity to study something different.
That's a great choice. I totally endorse that. Mm. Yeah, because otherwise you might not have done, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, with any decision, you just, whatever the decision is, you just make it the right decision.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because you can't second guess yourself.
Yeah.
Yourself with those things.
Yeah, it becomes the right thing.
Whatever. Sure. Yeah. You just put all your energy inside of it and make sure that you make it the right decision.
Yeah. But I think your reasoning was very sound. I think it's a good idea because certainly in those years, of all the places to go and study music in L.A., if you were into jazz, that was not necessarily thought of as the place. Although that has changed around a lot with Kenny Burrell being there.
And like I said, that was before Kenny
created
that department. So there actually was not, there was a jazz band, which interestingly turned out to be a really great band.
They always had a program, but they never were the place where the awards were won or the top kids weren't coming out of there. You didn't think of it that way. You just thought of it, and then there's UCLA. If you need to be at UCLA for some other reason, at least you can go play jazz. But it wasn't the main thing there. So that's cool. So you did a degree there? You did a music, a classical composition degree?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
MA?
I did the BA there.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. And then I actually didn't finish. that's the other side of it is that I had a great, I learned a tremendous amount the first couple of years. And then I started working a lot outside of school and doing a lot of playing and writing and working on my own projects as well. And all of a sudden, school just felt like a bubble, this place where it wasn't based in reality to me. And I remember, and I tell my students this, I remember walking to whatever general ed class I was walking to, geology or a math class or something, and I pushed through, for a long time, and then I kept walking. I couldn't go to the class, and I didn't finish. And I just continued to work in town, and it was fine, and then I ended up taking a job as a musical director out in Europe for a few years, and prior to that, I'd done a lot of teaching, probably out of balance, doing more teaching than doing anything else, just to pay bills.
And,
and it's funny, the first thing that I missed when I was doing this gig in Europe was teaching, because I missed having that exchange with students and hearing what they're going through and having to articulate things that may come more intuitively to me and when you're able to explain it and language you understand it even more clear about what you're going all those things that are and the actual gift of the service that's fulfilling.
I always say teaching keeps you honest because when somebody asks you, well, how did you make that change or what were you thinking over that chord? You have to explain it. They need to know the answer. Mm. And it keeps you aware of what you're doing in your own playing in a way that just playing doesn't do.
That's right.
It's a valuable. Well, I was away from it for about 15 years and I really missed it. I'm glad I have the time to do it now. But I know what you mean.
Yeah, I felt the impact in 2 weeks.
Mm-hmm.
So that's when I decided, okay, after I finished this run here, I'm gonna go back, I'm gonna finish that degree at UCLA and I'm gonna do the master's, do the doctorate so that I can teach at the university level because I want that in my life.
Right.
As long as I can create a balance between my artistic endeavors and also education.
What was the gig that got you to Europe?
That was a large production show, an ice skating show called Holiday on Ice.
Right.
And it was an interesting show. Holiday on Ice, the show was called In Concert, and it featured... I think there were 8 of us soloists that would interact with the choreography of the skating. And there was a jazz portion that was actually improvised. Some of it was improvised, which was fun.
Cool.
And it's actually a great show. So we did that for 3 years. And I was the MD, the musical director for it. And so that was an interesting experience as well. And it was a great way to see Europe, too, because we... we would stay in the larger cities for a month and a half, and I'd actually, you know, rent an apartment in the center of the...
So you feel like you live there, you're not a tourist.
Yeah, I'd go to the same cafe in the morning and get to know the, you know, the owners of the cafe and develop those relationships. So I really enjoy that aspect of it.
Yeah, it's cool. Sounds
although
like
musically,
gig.
Musically, it was kind of, you know, it's the best of times and the worst of times. Yeah. It was interesting.
Yeah.
Because I'd always had this fire and this this burning ambition to make music, something I thought would never go.
Mm-hmm.
And that flame went out, it felt like, in about 2 seconds after I started playing that show.
Wow.
Yeah, because you're playing the same music 10 shows a week.
Right.
And plus being the MD, it's your job to police everybody else to play everything
it's
the
hard
same
to
way every time.
It's hard to play well when you have responsibilities like that. I found it so.
Well, I mean, I played fine. It was just a matter of the creation part of it.
Well, that's
you
what
know,
I mean.
I wasn't able to write for the first time. I was able to, all I could really do was practice technique mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
Believe me, I tried everything. I, you know, that was still before the iPod came out. So I mean, I'd go to every record store and buy every record that I felt like I needed to try out that I hadn't heard yet, and you know, really absorbing a lot of material, which was great. But it still didn't light that fire again. And not until I came back and I actually started my master's over at CalArts, and being in that environment really let me come back to my creativity again.
Yeah. Did you quit the Holiday on Ice gig, or did it just run its course?
It ran its course. Yeah. I signed up to do it for 9 months, and I ended up meeting my wife on the show, and so it was a great way for us to kind of spend that time together. So we stayed 3 years, and that's how long the show ran. And then they develop another show after that. So it was a good amount of time. Mm-hmm. It was a perfect amount of time, actually. Yeah.
So CalArts a lot different than UCLA creatively. It's a whole different structure or lack of structure and all that. How did you end up there as opposed to?
You know, it's funny. You know, right before I decided to go take that gig, I got a call from David Roitstein inquiring if I would be interested in teaching over there, and UCLA had called as well asking the same thing, and I remember that, and I called David when I was thinking about getting the master's. And later I found out that he was on his sabbatical when I called him, because I called him at home. I didn't realize that was his home number. He spent an hour and a half with me on the phone.
Oh, that's nice.
Telling me, oh, he's one of the most generous human beings I've ever known. And he told me every possible positive thing about going to CalArts, he thought, for me, and every negative thing that possibly would come up by going to CalArts for me.
Yeah.
And the thing that I got out of that was, you know, if he's going to give me that amount of love and care and attention, there's nowhere else I want to go.
Yeah, that sounds like the
no
right
matter
answer.
If CalArts is like one room with one teacher in it and they don't have piano, you know, that's not the case. But the point being, I don't care what it is. If that guy's there, I want to be with that
guy. Yeah, it just felt like the place you ought to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So that was the idea. And it's interesting too, because I came back from Europe and I was in a place where I just gotten married, and so I was starting my young family, and so I had this idea of you know, really having to be financially sound, and so everything was about the money all of a sudden for me.
Yeah.
And I was working with an artist for David Foster. And where everything was certainly about the commercial aspect of being a professional, and that was great. It was really, I learned a lot of stuff doing those tours with him, but CalArts was the thing that allowed me to realize that being an artist doesn't have to attach the adjective starving. You don't have to be a starving artist.
Right.
You can be an artist. So you can have both worlds if you're able to balance that out. Because a lot of times the idols that we have, the self-made mentors that we have, maybe images of, you know, Mozart's unmarked grave.
Yeah.
And that's not necessarily the case.
Well, I mean, most of those people did not choose to starve. They didn't want to starve. It just kind of was that way, you know.
Yeah, but you can create a certain environment around yourself. Yeah. That's what you want to attract. So I felt like at that point at CalArts during those 2 years, I was able to find the middle ground.
Mm-hmm. It's a good place to be. Who was there when you were there? Who were your...
Let's see. You know, when I was there, one of the main people, for me anyway, was Gene Coy, mm-hmm. the drummer. And right. Gene's been playing with my groups now for, well, since that time.
Yeah.
That was 2004. So it's almost 10 years now that we've been working together. I heard him play two notes, and I said, that guy.
Yeah.
And Matt Otto was there, mm-hmm. Although we never saw each other at school. We would see each other, you know, elsewhere.
Yeah.
You know, it was more about the teachers, I think,
right. when
my time that I was there, because Larry Kuntz
right.
was there, and Dar Eccles, and Joe LaBarbera, and David Roitstein. Those were the real influences, and they gave that school so much caring mm-hmm. and attention.
Yeah, because when that school started, or when they moved it to there and it became CalArts, I mean, the jazz was not the main thing. It just right. sort of evolved mm-hmm. over a period of time, and now it's a serious place to go. And
I believe David and Charlie Hayden.
Yeah, Charlie Hayden was the main, what I think of as the main force. Mm-hmm. Buell Neidlinger was there. There were a lot of kind of very edgy people there. Mm-hmm. That you really couldn't meet anywhere else. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of creative musicians just gravitated to that because of that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cool. So that was a good place for you to be. You were in the place you needed to be at the time you needed to be there.
Yeah, it was very fortuitous.
Mm-hmm. So you did the 2 years there. You did the master's, or do you have a doctorate as well, or did you?
Yeah, I did the master's at CalArts, and then I did the doctorate over at USC.
Oh, right, USC.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So how long did it take you to get your doctorate? How long were you there?
That was a 3-year process,
right.
you know, including summers. That was a let's go process, because it's really about the degree is jazz studies,
right.
but you have all these minors to go through, and of course I was a teaching assistant, and you're teaching courses by yourself at the same time, mm-hmm. and you're
it's a heavy load. People I know who've been through that really have worked hard.
I think, you know, one of the main things that I learned through going through that process is the amount of work that I can accomplish in one period of time.
Mm-hmm.
Things that you just think, there's no way that's going to happen.
College does that, though. I've talked about this with other people, remembering that, you know, now somebody calls you for a chart or something, you go, oh my God, I've got to do this chart, I've only got 2 weeks or something. You think back when you were in college, man, we had to do a motet by Monday, and we had to do a big band chart by all this mm-hmm. stuff had to get done, and you just did it.
You just do it.
Of course, you have the energy of youth, which is part of it, but it's amazing what you can get done in college. Mm-hmm. You never reach that creative capacity again in your life. It's weird. Or you have to work harder to get it, I think. Mm.
Yeah, it's a question of maintenance, you know, to keep yourself in a certain state of heart and mind.
Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, I remember, you know, at its height, I remember one 2-week period when I was going to USC. It was over a summer, and I was one of the faculty members for the Grammys in the school
mm-hmm.
week Grammy camp that
yeah.
they have. And I was doing that during the day. You know, you start at 8 o'clock in the morning
right.
and you go. And I was also taking summer classes at USC at the same time
mm-hmm.
During the week. So I would cut out for an, you know, 2-hour period, then come back to the Grammy camp. That was just solid, you know, 8 until basically 9 or 10 o'clock at night. And then I would go, and at that time I was producing a record for James Torme, and,
mm-hmm.
and we'd do his vocals from, you know, 10 o'clock until 2 in the morning. And then you have to be at USC at 8 o'clock in the morning,
yeah.
plus, you know, the 2-hour drive
right.
to get there, because I live in the Valley. And And you just kind of do it, because
yeah.
you know, you have to know why you're doing it. You definitely have to know why you're putting yourself through that.
Yeah, you have to want both the process and the thing that's at the end of the process, you know, I think.
Yeah.
But we do it. Well, that's you do it to get to the end, but I think you also do it to get through what you're doing and learn for not just the actual thing that you're being taught, but you learn about yourself a lot when you're doing stuff like that. You learn
Absolutely.
What your capacities are and what you want to do, what you don't want to do.
Yeah, the end doesn't really matter.
Well, you're going to get to the end anyway, so
mm-hmm.
what's the difference?
Yeah, it's nothing you really need to be concerned about.
Yeah.
It's how much you can learn and grow from what you're doing.
Yeah, from
through
being
it.
On the way, on the journey.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. when did you start the big band? When did you decide that was going to be? I mean, we talked about that before, early in your life, but when did you actually put a big band together?
I first put it together, the big band, in, I think it was 96. It was after I took that final walk from UCLA, and I had this idea that I always loved the big band because it was a vehicle for me to write music. I could put myself in a soloistic light where I could show my strengths as an improviser, and I could write stuff for the band where I really heard it that way and get the power out of it, and really be a composer and player at the same time. So that was something that was important to me. So I started in 96, and we played here in L.A. for a while. Mm-hmm. We actually did a record at the old Catalina's, a live record.
Right.
John Guerin was playing drums, and cool. Bill Perkins played second alto, and I'm just so glad that we have that record. Oh,
yeah.
It warms my heart every time I hear those guys playing on that record. Mm-hmm. And then I moved to Europe, of course, in 2000, so that stopped that. We moved back in from Europe 2003 into 2003, and I didn't start the big band, I think, until 2007 again. And I decided, you know what, I want to do this again.
Yeah.
And I started writing, you know, a lot more new material, and I'd been playing with a group called Shogun Warrior over at the Baked Potato with Mike Elizondo, who I went to high school with, and Jeff Babko, who we all knew in high school, and Tos Panos, and Toshi Inagi. I've been doing that for a couple of years, the first Sunday of every month, and I asked the good folks over at the Baked Potato, Justin Randy, if he would let me do a last Sunday of every month. And so, you know, the first night we went over there, it's a small little place, as you know. And I was there with my tape measure, as if that was going to make any difference.
Trying to fit all those guys,
But we just fit. We just fit, and it sounds really good, and it's that perfect kind of like New York intimate.
Yeah. There's always been that energy at the Baked Potato. Mm-hmm. I was in the Baked Potato band. That's one of the first gigs I had when I came back to town after being on the road. And even then, talking about the mid-70s, there was an energy in that little place that has really never dissipated. It's always been the same kind of, you know.
It's all about the music.
Yeah.
It's all about the music, the potato. So that allowed us to really develop a personality together and an identity. And that's when Gene Coy started playing in the band and Jerry Watts on bass.
Right.
As well as Zane Carney, who I mentioned, who went to Hamilton after I did. It became this thing. It really became this thing. So we still do it. We play the last Sunday of every month there. And, you know, that's what really enabled us to put out a record that I'm so proud of.
Well, it's a fantastic record.
And thank you.
The guys I know who play with the band, Tom Peterson, people like that, just can't say enough about playing with you and the experience of
being with you. I can't say enough about Tom.
Yeah, he's a great guy. He's a great guy. But everybody likes to play with you and likes to play your charts. And the record reflects that. The cuts I've heard sound really, really great.
And thank
it's
you.
It's really good energy. And
That's what I'm getting at. We played with that band 3-4 years before we did the record. And that consistency of playing once a month and amongst other gigs in between, you really start to get a certain energy.
Yeah.
Because we can't be on the road at this point anyway. Mm-hmm. So that allowed that record to happen the way that it did.
Yeah, because your composition and the way you, the orchestration, but also the way you do things in sections and you kind of weave things together, it's different. It's not the same old spang, spang-a-lang big band that that people are used to hearing. It's nice to hear something different come out of that same basic thing.
Oh, good. Thank you.
I enjoy that a lot. So is there plans to do another record, or is it commercially viable, your band? I mean, is it something you can do and not have to worry about guys, you know, going off to take other gigs? And are they chasing you with helicopters, by the way?
I'd rather not talk about that.
Okay. I'll just let that go. Hopefully they're not coming for you or for me. Well, how does that work out? How are the economics of having a big band in 2012? Is it tough?
I'll let you know.
Yeah.
It's
a work in progress.
It's, you know, first and foremost, it's for the love of the music.
Yeah.
And that's why it works, because everybody in that band is doing it because they want to make the music together.
Mm-hmm.
And so the rest of it is up to me to just try and figure out and make sure that it's on a progression moving upward and going in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
I think the music itself is commercially viable to a certain point. So we're just going to have to see. It's a very young project.
Mm-hmm.
Have
you done festivals? Have you gone outside of LA with that?
No, that's the next step.
Mm-hmm.
It's really hard to travel with that amount of people.
Yeah,
so,
of course.
You know, to keep the money where it's supposed to be. But those are the things that we're working on right now. We're trying to make those budgets work so that we can do it. The interest is there. We're just trying to make the budgets work.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, before too much longer, we'll be able to do it.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing's been solidified yet.
Right.
I mean, the next project, we just recorded our small band record, which is kind of a similar approach that the big band had, only it's with less musicians.
Right.
But I've been playing with that group a long time, too.
It's the same guys, the same
pretty much,
basic
yeah.
core. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And that we are going to, we have solidified some festival appearances. And I think that will start to open up the idea of doing some appearances with the big band. The big band, also, we have a lot of educational possibilities that we can use with that band.
Yeah, clinics and the charts and all that.
Yeah, so those are the things that are starting to open up.
Talk to me a little bit about what you see as the future of jazz and creative music, especially here in LA. I mean, how it's changing. I mean, it in the years that I've been here and at the age I am, I mean, I see a lot of changes from the last 20 years and even the last 10 years. And I'm not sure that I'm totally optimistic about where things are going in terms of it being viable as a way to make a living. Have you thought about that? Is it something that you have thoughts about?
You just have to change with the times,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, well, yeah, certainly. But you have to, I mean, guys your age and guys my age, we are in the middle of it. We have to change with the times.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering where, like, the students you're teaching at Northridge and the students that I have, what's going to be for them in 10 years? How are they going to make a living out of music? I mean, I know what I think, but what do you think?
Everyone will have their own story. You know, it basically, you know, you have to be the best version of you.
Right.
You have to be the best at being you. And I firmly believe that if you're able to put in the work that it takes to become the best version of you, and it's always a work in progress, but if you're dedicated to that, there's a place for all of us to do just fine, because everybody's unique and everybody is going to pay you money to do you. That's been my experience, and I've seen it over and over with the artists that I really respect and admire. In terms of the business, you know, selling records is 20th century, and that's not going to happen anymore.
Right.
It's but the opportunities to be heard digitally, you know, via the internet, the opportunities to for live performance are going to be that much more cherished. To be able to experience music right in front of your eyes and feel that energy, that's never going to go away. So all you have to do is be the best at being you and have that to offer. And you got to work your behind off to do it.
Well, that's all you really can be. I mean, my attitude about that has always been, when you come into an audition or if you're doing a session or whatever it's going to be, you're all you can be is what you are. And if what you are is what's necessary for that slot, then that's great. You'll be fine. If it's not what you are, if that's not what they're looking for, then you don't have the gig anyway. So that doesn't even matter. You lost it before you even woke up that morning. You just have to be yourself.
You definitely can't, you know, I'll just speak to my experience of a lot of the work in LA is the phone rings, right?
Yeah.
We need you to be here at this time and play this session. That's never been the way that I've chosen to operate, just because I don't think I do operate that way. For me, it's I got to create things for myself.
Right. Some people are comfortable with that sort of, it's interesting, you were in a band called Shogun Warrior. Some people are comfortable with that samurai way of making a living where you're always an instrument for hire. And it's one thing today and one thing another day.
Mm-hmm.
And some people are not comfortable with that, and there's various levels in between. I see that as being not really the future. And it's interesting. It's interesting when I talk to people your age who kind of feel the same way, that the creativity is what's important and not so much responding to every little situation that comes up, you know, if that's what you're saying. It seems to be what you're saying.
That's certainly a component of it.
Yeah.
I just mean that you really have to not be afraid of creating your own work environment.
Yeah.
You create the stuff around you. And everyone is capable of doing that, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
You just got to know why you're doing it.
Right, right. So where do you see for yourself going forward? Where do you see the opportunities? You continue to teach, and you have a full-time teaching position? Or
mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's the Northridge?
Cal State Northridge.
Yeah.
I'm kind of doing it right now. I just want to elevate everything that I'm doing, continue to elevate.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to be doing a lot more. I need to balance the, more performance time, and that's starting to happen,
mm-hmm.
With the teaching and with my family.
You have kids?
One daughter.
Yeah, how old?
She's just a year and a half.
Yeah.
So I'm just learning from that. So balancing all these three things, it feels like three separate lives sometimes, and the balance is to try and make it feel like one, so everything's connected.
Right.
So that's my challenge, is to just keep connecting those things a little bit better and better. I just want to keep making music, and I want to be able to give that. I want to be able to provide that for anybody that would like to partake in that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you sell your charts on your website, yes,
mm-hmm.
or some of them anyway.
Yeah.
Has that been a successful thing for you? You find your charts are going out other places?
It has been, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah, they're doing well.
Your music is complex. I mean, it's not easy. It's not exactly like any middle school is going to buy those charts and be able to play that stuff on site anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard other recordings of your, or other examples of people playing your stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and I've been doing quite a few clinics. They'll have some of my music, and I'll come in and work with the middle schools. You're right, but some high schools and colleges.
Right. That's got to be very satisfying, I would think.
Yeah, of course it is,
yeah.
And to see how they respond and feel like you're contributing to their passion and love for music. It's
mm-hmm.
it's really rewarding.
Yeah, you feel like you're a natural teacher. Have you ever thought about it that way?
I haven't thought about it that way.
Yeah. You seem to me like someone who would be a natural teacher.
Mm,
so that's
thank you.
Why I ask. Because I feel that way about myself as well. So
I see.
Some people teach and some people don't. And some
mm-hmm.
people have the ability to teach and they don't. And some people have no ability to teach, but yet they still, they still do.
Mm.
There's a continuum there.
It's definitely in the sense that I know I want that in my life. I guess it is a natural part of me
mm-hmm.
To want to be able to share that with people. I just try and, I as a teacher, I wish I had more method, but I'm always just trying to figure out what that individual needs and what that group really needs.
Yeah.
And I'm much more improvisatory as,
I think
which it seems like everything, every aspect in my life is very improvisatory.
I think good teachers are. I think that you can have. This is something that I learned because I started teaching just through a fluke. I started teaching very early when I almost didn't know anything about the guitar.
Mm.
All of a sudden, I had a guitar student, and after having a few, I realized you can't really have like a one size fits all approach. You can have certain things.
Well, I've always thought that
information that every student has to get, but boy, you can't think that everything is going to be the same, because as soon as you start thinking that,
you leave no room
for outliers or for rebels or for, mavericks.
I hate
that word, but mavericks of various kinds.
Yeah.
And you've got to be able to switch on a dime and accommodate someone who's got a different method of asking a question.
Well, I've noticed, the most successful people in their lives, maybe in music or not, they usually have some unorthodox approach
mm-hmm.
That works for them.
Yeah.
And so they recognize that. So that's where I'm coming from. I the way that I play trumpet, it's off to the side,
mm-hmm.
that's where the air comes out,
right.
on the side.
Right.
Just that's where the hole is. And I studied with John Fumo,
started.
And I said, let's try and fix this. Let's see if I can't play in the center. Maybe
mm-hmm.
I can be more effective. And he said, why?
and
I had a lesson with Wayne Bergeron, and he said,
yeah.
Why? Why would you do that? That tells me a lot about people at that level, how they think. So maybe there's a pattern there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, if you have something that works for you, it's true. Why would you mess with it? There'd be no good reason to really do
always
that.
Just want to get better.
Yeah.
That's why.
Yeah. but that might not. It's interesting. If you changed your basic technique like that, mm-hmm. I wonder if it would make you better or if it would just make you different in another way, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the music, I mean, I firmly believe that in terms of trumpet playing, the sound that's in your head, you can change your mouthpiece 150 times in the horn. But you basically have a sound in your head, and you're going to get that sound.
Right.
And then you just need to find, you know, the equipment stuff is
the
just
vehicle, yeah.
The best equipment to get you to that sound. But mm-hmm. you're always going to get to that sound no matter what. So, you know, maybe playing on the side for me is just another way that I get to that sound, too. So, because every time I try and play another way, it gets another sound, and then I want to get the other sound.
Right. No, you have to be what you are. I mean, it's sort of the theme of this, what we're talking about here.
Yeah.
You pretty much have to be what you are, even if it's unorthodox. And mm-hmm. certainly a lot of the best people or the people we admire the most for being creative are, you know, based it on not being orthodox, on not doing the same old thing.
But, you're asking me about commercial viability, mm-hmm. about a lot of these things. And I'll just say that the more, every time that I've tried to really figure that out, it backfires on me. And every time I just follow the sound, so to speak, the music, the creativity, mm-hmm. the money comes. And I know that that's not a very tangible way to say it, and maybe a little intangible to speak to younger people that are just starting out. But that's really what it's boiled down to for me.
You have a
1-year plan, you have a 5-year plan, you have your goals, and you got to know where you're going, you got to know what you're willing to do and what you definitely don't want to do, what you definitely would love to do.
That
have all those things in
teaching,
place,
especially teaching
and
kids.
Then don't expect any of it to happen and just follow
is
the music
mm-hmm.
for the love of it, for the passion of it, for the inspiration of it. And when your heart is really in that place, as your dog might say,
yes,
really
dog's trying to say something.
Really good things happen, and I can say that for me, that's always been the case. So, with all the sincerity in my heart, just follow the music, and work hard at it. You can't just follow the music like a jellyfish. You got to work hard to get that to that place and continue to work. But if you follow music, really good things will happen.
A lot of teachers are going to tell them, do this, do this, do this, and then do this, and then do this other thing, and then do this. And they're going to hear that a lot more than they're going to hear what you've been saying about finding your own thing and just sticking with it and letting the consequences happen as they will. I think that's an important message.
It is, but you know, let me also say that.
It's the first time the dog has ever been a big part of the podcast here.
Let me also say that, you know, you do have to explore
certainly
all those different parts of being a professional player. You know, you have to know, go deep into what Afro-Cuban music is. You have to go deep into what playing a James Brown piece is supposed to, what you got to do to lock into that. You got to know sonata form. You got to be able to analyze, you know, the second theme and, you know, all of that stuff. You need to know that stuff so that you can find what your thing is.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, because when you find what your thing is, everybody else will know that other stuff too. And if you want to be on that level, you have to be able to have that happen. It doesn't have to necessarily be the most important part of your technique or your conception as a creative player, mm-hmm. but it's got to be there or else people won't take you seriously.
Yeah. I mean, that was another part of my thinking too when I went to UCLA for the undergrad is okay, well, I'm not going to go to conservatory because if I go to UCLA, a really fine school, academic school, I'm going to learn about Shakespeare. I'm going to learn about, you know, geology, and I'm going to learn about all this stuff, which also is just directly applicable to being a musician, you know, to your music. You know, the fact that the world has destroyed and reconstructed itself, you know, how many times? I mean, that gives you some perspective. You
Absolutely.
Can write about that.
Well, that all it enriches you, too. The more you know, the more you...
it makes, you know, music is just a mirror of your own, you know, human beingness.
Right. Well, it's very cool. You thought a lot about this stuff, and not everybody does.
Yeah, it's interesting you put it that way, because I don't think I've thought about it very much. You know,
it seems like you have.
It's just something I'm kind of feeling my way through all of it. And, well, I guess it's, you know, I'll, I always think that music is, you know, there's the fundamental technique stuff. There's all the thinking stuff, the method, the scales, the harmony, all the things that you practice to get control over your craft. And then there's an intuitive part where you need to not think about that. You just feel it.
Well, the first stuff is the stuff that you can teach. The second part, you can't teach at all. You can't teach intuition.
No, you just make people aware of it.
Right, make people be open to
but
it when it comes.
Where people get stuck is when they're stuck on either side of that.
Yeah.
You know, they're either stuck on not being able to control their instrument, their craft, their writing because of technique, or they're stuck because they're at a mental, emotional, spiritual plateau where they need to bust out of that and stop using that technique. And everybody gets to that place, and then you have to figure out which side you need to bust out of.
Yeah.
So that's where I'm coming from. So my natural inclination is to feel stuff first, and then I got to figure out what the technique is to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And then once I figure out the technique, then I got to open up the feeling side again.
Right.
And that just takes me all to new places.
Yeah, it seems like with most interesting players and writers, that's kind of how the equation goes.
Yeah, you know? Well, that's part of the human experience.
Yeah, exactly. Well, this has been fun, man. Thank you for coming over. And what's your website? Tell the peoples how to get in touch with you.
Yeah, it's my name. It's johndaversa.com, JohnDaVersa, .com. And I've got a Facebook page and a Twitter page and all the rest.
Right.
And Junk Wagon, the big band album, is out on BFM Jazz.
Mm-hmm.
You can find it on Amazon and everywhere else.
Right. And also on your website.
Mm-hmm.
Very cool. And we'll look for the big band. You're still doing the Baked Potato gig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Last Sunday of every month. And we play with a small band the third Monday of every month at a place called Seven Grand. And also at a new place. Well, it's an old place, but a new place that's having jazz called The Joint.
Oh, The Joint. Yeah, I just saw a flyer for that.
We're playing there on Tuesday. We're going to play the last Tuesday of every month.
Cool. That's with the small band?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, because we've got that record coming out in the fall with the small band.
Cool.
Onward and upward, just making music.
Yeah, man. Mm-hmm. Well, thanks. Good luck with everything.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.